Chapter 24. On the slope of the tabletop mountain that crouches over the town of Pietermaritzburg, there is a glade among the wattle trees. It is a secret place where even the timid little blue buck come out to graze in daylight. On a still day, you can hear very faintly the pop of the wagon whips on the road below, or further off the steam whistle of a train. But that is all that intrudes in this wild place. A butterfly crossed the glade in uncertain, wobbling flight. It came out of the sunlight into the dappled, moving shade along the edge and settled. "That's good luck," Sean murmured lazily, and Ruth lifted her head from the plaid rug on which they lay. As the butterfly moved its wings, fanning them gently, the iridescent green and yellow markings sparkled in the speck of sunlight that pierced the roof of leaves above them and fell upon it like a spotlight. "It tickles," she said, and the insect moved like a living jewel across the smooth white field of her belly. It reached her navel and paused. Then the tiny tendril of its tongue uncurled and dabbed at the fine sheen of moisture that their loving had left upon her skin. "He's come to bless the baby." The butterfly skirted the deep, delicately chiselled pit and moved on downwards. "Oh, don't you think he's being just a little forward? He doesn't have to bless that as well."
"He certainly seems to know his way around," Sean admitted dubiously.
The butterfly found its road southwards blocked by a forest of dark curls, so laboriously it turned and retraced its steps towards the north. Once more it detoured round her navel and then headed unerringly for the pass between her breasts.
"Keep right on, friend," Sean cautioned.
But it turned suddenly and climbed the steep slope until at last it sat triumphant on the peak. Sean watched it throbbing its wings, blazing in oriental splendour upon her nipple, and he felt himself stirred once more.
"Ruth,"
his voice was husky again. She rolled her head to look into his eyes. "Go away, little butterfly," and she brushed it from her breast. Later, after they had slept a little, Ruth woke him, and they sat facing each other on the rug with the open hamper between them. While Sean uncorked the wine, she worked over the hamper with the dedication of a priestess preparing a sacrifice. He watched her split the bread rolls and fill them with salty yellow butter, then open the screw-top jars of soused beans and pickled onions and beetroot. A heart of young lettuce rustled crisply as she plucked its leaves into a wooden bowl and poured dressing over them. Her hair, released from its braid, broke like a black wave over the marble of her shoulders, then rippled and swung with the small movements of her body. With the back of her hand she brushed it from her forehead, then looked up at him and smiled. "Don't stare, it's bad manners." She took the glass he offered her and sipped the cool yellow wine, set it aside, and went on to dismember the fat-breasted chicken. Pretending to ignore his eyes upon her body, she began to sing softly the love song she had sung on the night of the storm, and shyly her breasts peeped at him through the black curtain of her hair. She wiped her fingers carefully on a linen napkin, took up the wine glass again, and with elbows on her knees leaned forward slightly and returned his scrutiny with equal frankness. "Eat," she said.
"And you?"
"In a little while. I want to watch you."
Then he was hungry.
"You eat the way you make love, as though tomorrow you die."
"Well, I'm taking no chances."
"You're covered with scars, like an old tomcat who fights too much." And she leaned forward and touched his chest with one finger. "What happened there?"
"Leopard."
"And there?" She touched his arm.
"Knife."
"And there?"
His wrist. "Burst shotgun."
She dropped her hand and caressed the fresh purple cicatrice that twined around his leg like some grotesque parasitic vine. "This one I know," she whispered, and her eyes were sad as she touched it. Quickly, to change her mood, he spoke.
"Now it's my turn to ask the questions."
He reached across and laid his open hand upon her stomach, where the first faint bulge pressed warmly into his palm.
"What happened there?"
he demanded, and she giggled before she replied.
"Burst shotgun?
Or was it a cannon?" When she had repacked the hamper, she knelt beside him. He lay flat on his back, with a long black cheroot between his teeth. "Have you had sufficient?" she asked.
"My God, yes," and he sighed happily.
"Well, I haven't," and she leaned over him, took the cheroot from his mouth, and flicked it into the brambles. With the first faint flush of evening in the sky, a small breeze came down from the mountain and rustled the leaves above them. The fine hairs upon her forearms came erect, each on its tiny pimple of goose flesh, and her nipples stood out dark and hard. "You must not be late back to the hospital on the very first day they've let you out." She rolled away from him and reached for her clothing. "Machen will have me hung, drawn, and quartered." Sean agreed. They dressed quickly, and she was remote from him, all the laughter gone from her voice, and her face cold and expressionless. He stood behind her to lace the whalebone corset. He hated to cage that lovely body, and was about to say so. "Saul is coming tomorrow. 1 month's leave." Her voice was harsh. His hands stilled, and they stood without moving. It was the first time either of them had referred to Saul since that morning, 1 month ago, when she had come to him at the hospital.
"Why didn't you tell me sooner?" His voice also harsh.
"I didn't want to spoil today." She had not turned towards him, but stood staring out across the glade to the far hills beyond the town.
"We must decide what we're going to tell him."
"There is nothing to tell him," she answered flatly.
"But what are we going to do?"
Now his voice was ugly with mingled dread and guilt. "Do, Sean?" She turned slowly, and her face was still cold and expressionless.
"We are going to do nothing. Nothing at all." "But you belong to me," he cried in protest.
"No," she answered.
"The child, it's mine."
At his words, her eyes narrowed and the sweet line of her lips hardened in anger.
"No, damn you, it isn't. Not yours, although you sired it."
She flamed at him. It was the first time she had unleashed her temper at him. It startled Sean. "The child belongs to Saul, and I belong to Saul. We owe you nothing."
He stared at her. "You don't mean that."
And the flames of her anger faded. Quickly, he tried to press his advantage.
"We'll go away together."
"Run away, you mean? Sneak away like a pair of thieves.
What would we take with us, Sean? The happiness of a man who loves and trusts us both? That and our own guilt? You'd never forgive me, nor I you. Even now, when we talk of it, you cannot meet my eyes. Already you are beginning to hate me a little."
"No, no."
"And I would hate you," she whispered. "Call for my horse, please."
"You don't love him."
The agonized accusal was wrung from him, but it was as though he had not spoken. She went on dressing. "He'll want to see you. Half of every letter he writes is about you. I've told him that I've visited you at the hospital."
"I'm going to tell him," Sean shouted. "I'll tell him everything."
"No, you won't," she answered him calmly.
"You did not save him at Colenso to destroy him now. You would destroy him, and us. Please call for my horse."
Sean whistled. And they stood together, not touching, not talking, not even looking at each other, until Mbijani emerged from the bush below the glade leading the horses. Sean lifted her into the saddle.
"When?"
he asked quietly.
"Perhaps never," she answered, and swung the horse away.
She did not look back, so Sean never saw the tears that streamed down her face. The muffled drum of hooves drowned her sobs, and she held her back and her shoulders stiff so that he would not know.